3,000 years ago, a monster seizes six sailors from the ship of Odysseus and throws them down her screaming maw. 300 years ago, a Danish historian writes about a sea beast a mile and a half in circumference. 150 years ago, two men in a rowboat are attacked by a creature with limbs dozens of feet long. 16 years ago, the animal is caught on camera. 120 years ago, a 10,000-pound faceless mass of flesh arrives on the shores of Anastasia Island. 80 years ago, an English author writes of a beautiful decaying giant that lies on the coast. 50 years ago, ocean researchers attempt to pull up their anchor and discover that something no one has ever seen has swallowed it. 18 years ago, the waters on the edge of India draw back and reveal structures outside of living memory. A minute later, those waters smash back into the land. 6 years ago, a glacier collapses and releases a part of itself not meant to be seen. Months ago, a reservoir drops to perilously low levels and uncovers a crime from a different century. The history of our relationship with the deep is written in unknowables. Time and again, we declare something impossible, only to discover it's already happened. Confine a phenomenon to myth until it proves itself beyond all doubt. I am not here to lecture you on what does not exist. I am here to tell you what lurks just out of view, beyond our knowledge, and below the waves. It's hard to define just how many myths are, in one way or another, about the Kraken. The giant tentacled beast's earliest specific mention may have been King Sverre of Norway in the year 1180. But what of Scylla, the sea monster from the Odyssey, with 12 writhing legs, many screaming heads, and countless fangs? What about the Bible's Leviathan, a multi-headed, multi-limbed monster boasting a mouth ringed with fearsome teeth? Some of our earliest and most influential texts include not just mentions, but whole encounters with similar-sounding abominations. 600 years after King Sverre, Erik Pontoppidan fleshed out his country's history with the Kraken in his book, The Natural History of Norway. This wasn't a speculative work, according to Pontoppidan. The book declares itself a particular and accurate account of the temperature of the air, the different soils, waters, vegetables, and so on. And yet, 200 pages in, he writes this: "The Kraken. This creature is the largest and most surprising of all the animal kingdom." He says that fishermen may sense the presence of the creature by an abundance of fish, but if the water seems to grow shallower, they need to get the hell out of there before an enormous monster comes up to the surface of the water. He writes that no human has ever seen its true body, but its back alone is a mile and a half in circumference, that it at first looks like a number of small islands, that the horns on its head stand as tall as ships, that when it sinks back down below, it causes a whirlpool that sucks the surrounding sea down with it. As a kid, I was obsessed with the idea of the Kraken. I pored over illustrations of tentacles grappling with warships. I read every myth and legend I could find. I wrote a report on it for my school, elementary school, and still have vivid memories of waking up in the middle of the night and writing furiously, my waking and sleeping brain both tangled up in the creature. Since assessing any individual story's truthfulness was well beyond me, since every piece of literature held basically an equal amount of historical possibility, it was easy to decide which ones were my favorite. It all came down to size. Modest krakens, ones that ate one or two sailors, wrestled with individual boats, were fine, interesting even. Tentacles that stretched dozens of feet were undeniably neat. But I didn't simply want large. I wanted vast, unfathomable. I wanted a god that would emerge like the birth of a new continent, that could plummet down further than we could ever follow. I wanted something eldritch, years before I ever learned the word. And the Kraken worked for that. Not just because of its fabled enormity, but because it seemed impossible to disprove. Sure, we didn't have photographic evidence, but we had all these stories, and the deep sea could hide so many secrets. Nothing could suppress my desire to believe in big things underwater. Reading about the sailors of centuries ago feels a lot like reading about astronauts. They're totally isolated in an alien, inhospitable world, one that virtually no one else would ever see, and one that would kill them without passion. Can you imagine surviving that vacuum, witnessing something impossible, and then returning to shore and having people tell you, "Oh, you probably just imagined it." Such was the case for many sightings of giant tentacled beasts at sea. For example, a French steamship in 1861 encountered a squid so large that their harpoons and muskets didn't seem to affect the creature. They managed to lasso the thing, but only pulled a piece of its flesh on board. Nevertheless, they took it to the French Academy of Sciences, where a zoologist informed them that they had nothing but a rotten bit of sea plant. He said that the existence of the animal they described would contradict the great laws of harmony and equilibrium, which have sovereign rule over living nature. They lasso a squid, and this dork just tells them they probably grabbed some seaweed? There are plenty of these types of stories. The existence of some kind of big squid was well known enough that it even makes an appearance in the distinctly not sci-fi Moby Dick. They see a pulpy mass furlongs in length with innumerable long arms radiating from its center. But it wasn't until 23 years after Moby Dick that anyone managed to obtain convincing proof. In 1873, off the coast of Newfoundland, a fisherman named Theophilus Picot saw something attached to his rowboat, and he smacked it with an oar, only to have the something reveal itself as a massive tentacled creature that reportedly attacked the boat with its beak and threw its arms over the entire vessel. Picot then grabbed a hatchet and attacked it, fighting it off and hurriedly rowing back to shore through the hundreds of yards of ink that it shot out. And this would have probably ended like every other sailor's unbelievable tales of ocean monsters, except Picot didn't come back empty-handed. He had severed one of the animal's tentacles with his axe and gave it to a museum. The tentacle was 19 feet long. The animal Picot fought was not Scylla or the Leviathan or Norway's mile and a half long kraken, but it was a squid, and it was giant. It was a giant squid. Architeuthis ducks. Finally, no one could deny that the animal was real. It wasn't just legend, it absolutely exists. What's almost as exciting to me, though, is the absolute desert of evidence between 1873 and today. People have found a handful of Architeuthis corpses, but the first time it was caught on video was in 2006, and there have been, I don't know, three other recordings since then. It is astonishingly elusive. An animal 40 feet long, hundreds of pounds, and the number of people who have seen one alive could probably fit in this room. And if sailors have something in common with astronauts, Architeuthis has even more in common with an alien. Wendy Williams writes, "In many ways, the sea is more celestial than earthly. The giant squid spends its time in a dark void surrounded by pinpricks of bioluminescence. Prior to the 20th century, encounters with it were almost indistinguishable from alien sightings, fleeting glimpses that leave people raving about impossible sights to a disbelieving audience. And its biology is distinct enough to feel completely alien as well. 3/5 of a giant squid's brain is in its tentacles. Individual arms can move and maybe even think after being severed from the main body. It could be smart, it could be a genius. Because we've had so few encounters with Architeuthis, we can really only guess at its brain power. Even if we did have extended contact, how would we ascertain what or how it thinks? Is it unreasonable to suggest that we can intuit some level of intelligence from the giant squid because we've had vanishingly few interactions with them? Like intelligent alien species, could they have seen what we're up to and simply decided they don't want to get involved? Of course, we don't even know that all those sailors' encounters with tentacled sea beasts were with the giant squid. They could have been with the colossal squid, Mesanthicotuthis hamiltoni, the giant squid's shorter but far beefier relative. They could have seen the absolutely bizarre big fin squid, Magna pinna, or even a giant Pacific octopus, Enteroctopus dofilani, which can theoretically grow past 600 pounds. There was a time when some educated scientists of the Victorian age believed it impossible that life could actually exist thousands of feet below the surface of the ocean under crushing pressure and absolute darkness. They were incorrect, of course. As deep as we can go in the ocean, we find life. And it's hard not to look at our history of underestimating what the ocean holds and wonder about other myths. The giant squid exists. How about Namazu or Bakunawa, undersea beasts of Japan and the Philippines respectively, which both cause earthquakes with their movement? How about the Loch Ness Monster, hidden for centuries within Scotland's peaty depths? Or hell, why not a megalodon or other prehistoric sharks? Is it so unreasonable that an animal that's proved itself through millions of years of survival of the fittest would be able to stay out of our way? This isn't even really a theoretical question. In his book Monsters of the Sea, which I will reference throughout this video, Richard Ellis tells the story of scientists off the coast of Hawaii conducting deep sea observations. Preparing to leave, they hauled in one of their anchors, which had been hanging out about 500 feet below, and brought with it a 14-foot shark that neither they nor anyone else had ever seen before. The megamouth shark, named because anyone's guess, really, is not a new species. It's been around basically as long as any other shark. And yet we found our first one in 1976. There is simply so much deep sea that even the largest creatures are dwarfed by the amount of nothing behind them. There's actually a concept called deep sea gigantism, the paradoxical phenomenon that in the abyss, where food is scarcest and pressure is most severe, organisms get bigger. Isopods 2 feet long, spider crabs with a 12-foot arm span. There are still so many questions that remain about what and why and how that the line between fiction and fact feels blurrier than normal. Is any given author making something up? Or are they inadvertently prophesizing flora and fauna we'll later find out to be true? Years before Theophilus Picot severed a giant squid's tentacle with a hatchet, Jules Verne penned almost the same event in his sci-fi classic, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Immediately after a conversation where one crew member scoffs at the idea of a kraken, their submarine is seized by a massive tentacled devilfish. Captain Nemo grabs an axe and gets to chopping, cutting off 7 of its arms. The creature then disappears in a cloud of ink, just like Picot's squid would. Life imitates art. Perhaps hoping to predict a future discovery, many science fiction stories have tackled the idea of extraterrestrial marine biology, what may lie under the oceans of other planets. And, credit to them, these stories often feel more plausible than our other guesses at alien life. An exemplary model of this kind of world construction is the indie gem In Other Waters, which builds an entire functioning ecosystem through little more than text descriptions and HUD elements. Maybe it's easier for us to buy into these other worlds because our own oceans feel so full of aliens. Another sterling example of this is the game Subnautica. Set on an entirely oceanic moon, Subnautica is a survival game where players have to gather various resources in order to stay alive and explore deeper into the underwater map. But the game doesn't just present resources to gather, it creates an entire biosphere. Unlike some of its survival game ilk, Subnautica's circle of life doesn't revolve around the player. Almost every plant and animal can be scanned and learned about, but most will not help you craft a better battery or stronger diving suit. The imposing reef backs exist because they're a vital part of the moon's cycle of life, not because they're a source of resources for you to exploit. Because only a fraction of the wildlife can be corralled and harvested, Subnautica never gives the feeling like you're conquering the environment, only finding your place in it. And your place, notably, is not at the top. The most famous image from Subnautica, more iconic than the game's start screen or main character, or any peaceful and beautiful fish, is the Leviathan. Almost 200 feet long, a Reaper Leviathan is the first reminder you get that not only is this ocean dangerous, it is a food chain you will never be on top of. The Reaper screams so loudly it feels like it's everywhere, and yet the ocean's cloudiness means it also always feels like it appears from nowhere. It's capable of swallowing you whole, but I've also experienced a far crueler interaction with the beast. Occasionally, even in the depths of Subnautica, you have to climb out of your submersible and swim in the open water. And one such time, I climbed out of my sub hundreds of yards below the surface, began to swim, then heard a scream and turned around to see a Leviathan devouring my empty submarine. It swam off with the shattered pieces of the vehicle, leaving me technically alive, but absolutely screwed, drowning and unreachably far from the surface. Subnautica is a game that triggers thalassophobia, a term people have likely been screaming for this entire video, a fear and or fixation on the open ocean. A peek at the thalassophobia subreddit reveals divers over bottomless pits, waves sweeping past tiny portholes, and countless fish swirling in organic whirlpools. What thalassophobia doesn't quite communicate, what doesn't have a word as far as I can tell, is the misfortune of things that should remain deep underwater being brought to the surface. The plot of China Mieville's convoluted novel Kraken centers around Billy Harrow, a museum employee whose most notable achievement is preserving the corpse of a recovered Architeuthis in formaldehyde. One day, Billy enters the museum to find the entire creature has disappeared into the city's underbelly. He goes in search of the corpse and finds a world full of various cults worshiping various gods, including a squid cult. But they swear they didn't steal it. The preserved giant squid obviously holds a religious significance for the cult, but they're sure to draw a line between that specimen and the true Kraken, their actual deity. The Kraken, almost by definition, could never be captured, never be preserved, nor even fully understood. Naming, classifying Architeuthis is near blasphemous to them. The squid cult says, and I quote, "What was squidity, but otherness, incomprehensibility?" And although Billy, the protagonist, is not as invested in squid lore as the rest of the cult, he can't help but feel a bit conflicted about the myth of the preserved squid versus the reality of its capture. Visitors to the museum arrive with visions of legendary seafaring encounters, visions that clash with the scientific sterility of a dead squid in a vat of formaldehyde. Billy thinks, "Visions of an army of coils 20,000 leagues, an axe fight against a blasphemy from the deep below, a predatory meat cylinder, rope limbs unrolling, finding a ship's rail with ghastly prehensility." It had been nothing like that. A giant squid at the surface was a weak, disoriented, morbid thing. Horrified by air, crushed by its own self, it had probably just wheezed through its siphon and palsied, a gel mass of dying. His description makes me think of the first Architeuthis we captured on camera, accidentally hooked on a fishing boat, not an exemplar of its species. We've observed the most desperate giant squids, the starving. Real-life zoologist Clyde Roper has said the same thing. The only ones you catch are the slow, the sick, and the stupid. There's a sharp distinction between the first video, lost and tangled and drowning, and our subsequent recordings of its alien magnificence in the deep where it actually lives. Our pictures of it without this vital context are gross, almost disrespectful. Our interactions with it on our home turf deny the squid its majesty, and Mieville's telling its godliness. But what do you do when a dead god just washes up on your front doorstep? For as long as people have ventured out onto the ocean, they've returned with stories of impossible creatures. Many have proven to be true. Others, like the time your uncle almost caught a fish that was this big, still strain credulity. Most challenging of all, though, is when the existence of the thing is not in question, but what the thing is still eludes us. In 1896, on the beach of Anastasia Island, just off the coast of Florida, two boys discovered a giant thing, a lump,
a blob, the remains of who knows what. They fetched the founder of the St. Augustine Historical Society, who measured the thing at 21 feet long, 7 feet wide, 4 feet high, and somewhere between 5 and 7 tons. It was white and rubbery and incredibly tough. Richard Ellis describes it as 5 tons of protoplasm. Most mystifying of all, while the blob didn't have a head or intact limbs, or bones or organs, it did have what appeared to be stumps protruding from its mass. It had enough of these tubular stumps that upon hearing its description, Yale zoologist Addison Verrill declared an entirely new species of cephalopod, Octopus giganteus. In 1887, Verrill wrote for the New York Herald that the creature, when intact, would have weighed 18 to 20 tons. Each arm of the animal would have been at least 100 feet long, as thick as the mast of a large vessel and covered in suckers. He said, "We must reflect that wherever this creature had its home, there must be living hundreds or even thousands of others of its kind, probably of equal size. Otherwise, its race could not be kept up."
In 1964, author J.G. Ballard published a short story called The Drowned Giant. The story, recently repopularized by an adaptation in Netflix's Love, Death, and Robots, tells of an enormous man's corpse that washes ashore on the beach of a village. The story's narrator, a local scientist, goes to visit the giant and watches a growing crowd interact with the body, first trepidatiously, then gleefully, climbing its arms, jumping on its nose, sliding down its jaws. The giant, as mysterious as it is, becomes a sort of public gathering space. People picnic and watch the thing, children treat it as a playground. But for the scientist, the magnetism of the giant isn't the particulars of his musculature, but the mere fact that he simply is.
What I found so fascinating was partly his immense scale, the huge volumes of space occupied by his arms and legs, which seemed to confirm the identity of my own miniature limbs. But above all, the mere categorical fact of his existence. Whatever else in our lives might be open to doubt, the giant, dead or alive, existed in an absolute sense, providing a glimpse into a world of similar absolutes, of which we spectators on the beach were such imperfect and puny copies.
The St. Augustine monster isn't the only of its kind. 64 years later, on the coast of Tasmania, two men discovered another blob, 20 feet long by 18 feet wide, and somewhere between 5 and 10 tons. It similarly had no identifiable head, bones, or structure. Almost as inexplicable, the thing, deemed a globster by cryptozoologists, sat on the beach for a year and a half without meaningfully decomposing. The only thing it lost in that span of time was a layer of fine, greasy hair. Apparently, it didn't even have a smell. Bill Mollison, an Australian biologist and one of the investigators, said, "One tends always to reject the fact that an animal is unknown. One is always seeking some explanation, and you try and add up everything, but this one does not add up. The more I looked, the more I was convinced that it conformed to no known animal."
As time goes by in Ballard's story, fewer people visit the giant. Whereas it had once been near beautiful, with a Grecian profile and resemblance to sculpture, the time on the beach ages the giant. Its cheeks swell and skin sags with tumefaction. Ballard writes that his ongoing decomposition changes even the perceived personality of the giant. As the body continues to surrender to that all-demanding system of time, his face hints at a growing corruption to come. There is still no indication of where the giant came from, other than simply out of the sea.
1968 saw the emergence of another globster, as did 1970 and 1988. As Ellis writes, one of the core similarities between each blob is they're nearly impossible to cut. The one in 1988 was described as like trying to cut a car tire, and the Tasmanian one from the 60s broke 3 blades of a pathologist's knife and only gave up tiny fragments of itself. But samples of it were retrieved. Today, due to a combination of preservation and the blob's inherent durability, we can examine the old material with new technology.
One day, in Ballard's story, the scientist comes back and the head of the giant has been removed. He is relieved. Each day previous, the creature became less elegant, less marvelous, more covered in the dirt and grime of our world.
Despite his immense size, the bruises and dirt that covered his body made him appear merely human in scale, his vast dimensions only increasing his vulnerability, as each of the limbs was chopped off, first at the knee and elbow, and then at shoulder and thigh. The carcass resembled that of any headless sea animal, whale, or whale shark.
The community claims the giant as its own abandoned site. Graffiti and carvings mock its once clear skin. Its hand and foot become material for fertilizer and cattle food. A shack simmers its blubber. The giant's body, in parts, remains. But the giant as a concept disappears from memory.
Electron microscopy has revealed that chunks of the unidentified blobs have basically the same molecular makeup as whales. They bear little resemblance to a cephalopod, octopus giganteus, or otherwise. Even before modern analysis, many of the original scientists revised their observations. Verrill himself, who proposed the octopus, said later that the St. Augustine monster was some part of a sperm whale. Although this theory would require a sperm whale to have features that have never been observed before. As time passes, the mystery of the blobs are smoothed over, nominally explained, though never quite answered. The most recent blob of a similar type appeared on a Chilean beach in 2003, a full 14 tons and nearly 40 feet across. It, too, was ultimately deemed to be some remnant of a sperm whale.
As the drowned giant gradually disappears from the beach, it reappears throughout the town. Thigh bones frame the meat market. A carnival displays the right hand. Pieces of its ribs frame a garden, though the ribs are misidentified as the jaws of a whale. The village assimilates the giant and scrubs away its otherworldliness. Even the enormous penis of the giant, which is preserved and dragged along with a circus, is normalized to some extent.
The irony is that it is wrongly identified as that of a whale, and indeed most people, even those who first saw him cast up on the shore after the storm, now remember the giant, if at all, as a large sea beast.
I will not, as much as I want to, deny the findings of electron microscopy. If the best data we have says that these vast and alien blobs are in fact some part of a whale, then sure, I don't have the expertise to disagree. But I am not so eager to categorize the uncategorizable, to cordon off the unknown until it becomes the known. Tales of a giant squid were laughed off and rationalized until faced with undeniable proof. The megamouth shark has existed for millennia and yet simultaneously didn't exist until we dragged one up in 1976. 126 years ago, a 5-ton headless, limbless blob of protoplasm washed up on a beach in Florida. On that beach, the creature was a gigantic octopus of a species heretofore never seen. A century later, we know the St. Augustine monster came from a whale. A century from now, we may know differently yet again. Of course, a century from now, mysterious blobs will likely be the least of the things released from the waters of our world.
One particular image I've never been able to get out of my mind came just before the devastating tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004. A warning sign for tsunamis is the draw back, when the entire ocean seems to pull away from the land before crashing back in. And in 2004, during this draw back, just before waves dozens of feet tall would strike the shore, people on the coast of the Indian state of Tamil Nadu saw something emerge from under the water. Dark lines of stone rose out of the receding sea and sand, not random boulders, but architecture. Just south of where these ruins were spotted stand the remnants of the ancient city of Mahabalipuram, a city fabled to have once been much grander than the few monuments that remain today. Just before the tsunami hit, witnesses unlucky enough to be on the shore caught a glimpse of the true scale of ancient Mahabalipuram. The archaeological vision of a lifetime at an impossibly high cost. I have to wonder if future generations will have the same experience living in a world where the oceans have swallowed our present-day coasts. Imagine a tsunami in 2150, humans seeing the oceans draw back just before disaster to expose, I don't know, like a drowned Taco Bell or something. Those same swelling seas are also driving another phenomenon, the increased frequency of glacier calving. Calving is the term for glaciers or icebergs fragmenting, coming apart and falling into the sea. It is a somewhat inevitable process, the result of the constant erosive power of the waves and impossible weight of ice that is nevertheless accelerated due to our warming planet. And while calving appears to be things falling into the ocean, not emerging from it, occasionally the two go hand in hand. Nature writer Robert McFarlane wrote about an experience he had near the Knud Rasmussen Glacier in Iceland, in which he watched a veritable city of ice detach from its mother glacier and plummet into the water below. And then, the calving reveals something more. And then something terrible happens, which is that out of the water where the city has fallen, there upsurges, or so it seems from where we are standing, right to the summit of the calving face itself, a black shining pyramid, sharp at its prow, thrusting and glistening, made of a substance that has to be ice, but looks like no ice we have seen before, something that resembles what I imagine meteorite metal to be, something that has come from so deep down in time that it has lost all color. And we are dancing and swearing and shouting, appalled and thrilled to have seen this repulsive, exquisite thing rise up that should never have surfaced, this star-dropped berg surge that has taken 3 minutes and 100,000 years to conclude. Though McFarlane's sighting was nowhere near as dangerous nor shadowed by tragedy as that of Mahabalipuram, I can't help but feel a connection between them, the sea relinquishing what's hidden just before the end. This thread continues into the unlikeliest of places. For instance, the landlocked Salt Lake City. As reported by Christopher Flavelle for the New York Times, the largest city in Utah is sitting next to a, quote, environmental nuclear bomb, the eponymous Salt Lake. While the oceans begin to rise, the Salt Lake is going the opposite direction. A combination of water overuse, decreased rainfall, and increased temperature mean that the lake is shrinking rapidly. It's a third of the size it was 30 years ago. This is, if I need to spell it out, bad. Decreased water means increased salinity, meaning wildlife will die off in droves. The water is also necessary to drink for the millions of people who live in the surrounding area. But the least obvious and potentially most dangerous result of the shrinking lake is what lies beneath it. God, wouldn't it be nice if it was a kraken or something? I wish it was a fucking kraken. No, under the Salt Lake is arsenic, copper, zirconium, dust, heavy metals, particulates, carcinogens. Instead of living next to a lake, residents could soon live next to a massive cancer-causing dust bowl in which choking clouds are kicked up by wind scouring the dry lake bed. And this isn't a theoretical, this exact situation has happened before. As Flavelle points out, Owens Lake in California completely dried up due to LA diverting water from its feeding river. Now, the lake is the single largest source of dust pollution in the United States. The particulate surrounding the lake was at one point 100 times higher than safe breathing levels. And in a move of supreme irony, one of the only ways to contain the poison from the lake bed is to spray it back down with water, hopefully weighing it down enough that it can't blow away. Through our own actions, we released a monster that was kept safely underwater. Through our own actions, we vainly try to drown it again. For more individual horror, you could look to Lake Mead, a precipitously dropping reservoir meant to serve Las Vegas and the Nevada area. Literally, as I write this, news is breaking that a third set of human remains has been found on the now dry lake bed. One was found stuffed inside a barrel, killed by a gunshot wound nearly 50 years ago. Officials say that more bodies will likely emerge as the water continues to fall. If it falls below 895 feet, water outlets will no longer be able to draw from the reservoir. It will become something else, a fittingly named dead pool. Its secrets revealed just before the end. One of the most memorable scenes from any book I read as a kid comes from the 11th entry of the 13-part series of unfortunate events, The Grim Grotto. The book largely takes place in a submarine, with the Baudelaires, as always, pursued by the evil Count Olaf. But partway through the story, there's a sequence in which the kids see something else on the submarine's sonar. Not Count Olaf's vessel, but something far more massive, a something so unknown that it literally takes the form of an enormous question mark on the sonar's readout. As you can imagine, this was electrifying for me, a kid already obsessed with big things underwater. A new threat, bigger than anything we've ever seen, more dangerous than Count Olaf? What could it be? And then the book just doesn't tell you. The kids ask the captain of the sub what it was, and he says, in so many words, that there are things in this world that you simply cannot imagine. He says that the sonar of their ship, the thing meant to let them see the outside, simply shows the shadows of things too great and terrible to be understood. This is also the concept, more or less, of a game released earlier this year called Iron Lung. Actually, I'd be doing you a disservice if I didn't give you the full concept. As succinctly as I can, every known star and habitable planet has vanished along with the people on them. The only people left are folks who were on spaceships when this happened. You are a convict from one of those spaceships. You are being forced to explore one of the few things remaining in the universe, a moon covered in an ocean of blood. The submarine you have to explore the blood ocean isn't designed for depth, so it's been welded closed and its windows have been covered. Good luck! The setup is important, both because it's probably the most metal thing I've ever read, and also because the game looks like this. A small metal room with a map, a steering mechanism, and a compass. Your goal is to navigate to every point of interest on this map and take a picture of what's there. However, since the window has been welded shut, the only way to know your location is using the X and Y axis provided on the map. And the only way to know what's outside at all is using the slow and grainy black and white camera fixed to the outside of the sub. This is a game in which the imagined world outside the playable area is far more important than the box you're allowed to walk around. Nothing, aside from the inherent claustrophobia, is visually scary about the inside of this box, and yet Iron Lung is absolutely terrifying. At times you'll have to pilot through canyons on the blood ocean's floor. Without visibility, your only tools for avoiding dashing yourself on the rocks are your positional coordinates and a flashing dot that appears on your compass, a sort of proximity alarm. The faster the dot flashes, the closer you are to colliding with the terrain. Except sometimes, the dot flashes when you're not near anything at all. And sometimes your entire sub shudders and then is a mile away from where it was a second ago, like you've been grabbed and pulled by some enormous question mark. The single scariest moment of the game happens about halfway through. Lost in the twists and turns of the map, my compass suddenly showed me a dot flashing incredibly close, appearing where no wall should be. I tried to navigate away, and it persisted. Finally, I swung the sub towards the dot, took a single picture, and most pictures you have to take are not nearly this legible. They could be decayed structures or rock formations or biological growths, and your interpretations will probably have as much to do with your pre-existing fears as any details of the actual photograph. And all the while, the sound design works to convince you of the endless pressure you're under, stuck in a metal box, welded shut. The first bathysphere, designed by William Beebe in the 1930s, wasn't a far cry from this box. It was a sealed steel globe, its door bolted shut, its small windows 3 inches thick. It dangled from the side of a ship off a winch that could barely hold it. Inside the steel globe, Beebe and his colleague used palm fronds to manually circulate the air. They descended almost half a mile beneath the waves, during which time the sphere swung side to side so violently they emerged bloody. The windows cracked, water seeped through the sealed entrance, and yet... I sat, crouched, with my forehead pressed close to the cold glass, that transparent bit of old earth which so sturdily held back 9 tons of water from my face. There came to me at that instant a tremendous wave of emotion, a real appreciation of what was momentarily almost superhuman, cosmic, of the whole situation. Two conscious beings sat and peered into the abyssal darkness as we dangled in mid-water, isolated as a lost planet in outermost space. The thing the Baudelaires saw in a series of unfortunate events is eventually referred to as the Great Unknown. It appears a couple more times. It is my understanding that in the extended universe of the fiction, it's explained more thoroughly. I've never really had an interest in that, though. For me, the most powerful version of its existence is just that one scene of the book, a question mark, vast, unknowable, the almost eldritch cognitive dissonance of desperately wanting to know more while simultaneously understanding there are things that are simply beyond us. I think about that great unknown a lot. Here, under a pressure which, if loosened in a fraction of a second, would make amorphous tissue of our bodies, breathing our own homemade atmosphere, here I was privileged to peer out and actually see the creatures which had evolved in the blackness of a blue midnight which, since the ocean was born, had known no following day. Here, I was privileged to sit and try to crystallize what I observed through inadequate eyes and to interpret with a mind wholly unequal to the task. To the ever-recurring question, how did it feel? I can only quote the words of Herbert Spencer. I felt like an infinitesimal atom floating in illimitable space.
The first giant squid ever caught on video was in 2006. And not only was it caught on camera, it was caught. Snared on a line and dragged to the surface, the writhing mass of tentacles is striking, yes, but a far cry from the Kraken that I've dreamed of. Horrified by air, crushed by its own self, it, like the repulsive, exquisite hidden face of an iceberg, feels intellectually exciting, but spiritually conflicted. The magic of the world revealed and reduced simultaneously. In roaring, he shall rise and on the surface die. In 1990, Bernard Heuvelmans wrote an article for the, stay with me, Journal of Cryptozoology. The piece's name alone is worth the price of admission. The metamorphosis of unknown animals into fabulous beasts and of fabulous beasts into known animals. In it, Heuvelmans traces the path that human imagination walks again and again. Tales of an impossible creature arise, a kraken, a mermaid, a blob, and pass into the realm of legend, mythologized by communities while rejected by the era's scientific concept of the world. Then, the reality of the myth is revealed by, for example, a sailor returning from the sea with a 19-foot-long tentacle. And quickly, the myth is once again bound by terrestrial ways of thinking. The Kraken is classified into the giant and colossal squid. Mermaids are retitled manatees. 5 to 7 tons of beach-bound protoplasm has the same molecular structure as a whale. Fabulous beasts are relegated to the more respectable, less spectacular title of known animals. And yet, 7 years and 13 years after that undulating Architeuthis was pulled to open air, researchers followed the squid down, submitting to its world instead of demanding it submit to ours. Captured on video, but this time unrestrained, the squid is a wholly different creature. An alien of massive size and unknowable intelligence gliding through the deep like a dancer. The Kraken reveals itself again. Monsters are not about to die. Not that they are eternal. Surely they were born with human thought and will vanish with it. Yet I wish a long survival to all the animals of flesh and blood that were successively embodied in them, that somehow fed them and kept them alive, all for the comfort of our souls. We owe them that, at least. The difference is a matter of deference. I do not mean to imply that the deep should keep its mysteries forever. I delight in every new taxonomy, obsess over new answers raising new questions. But the romantic, poetic side of me knows that sightings of the true legends have to be earned. We cannot understand those depths by the refuse that floats to its surface. Meeting the great unknown on its own turf requires a sort of surrender. We must give ourselves to the deep before the deep will give its knowledge in return.
Still be seen.